Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, welcome along to Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking every Saturday with me, Justin Brierley. And today is Holy Saturday, the day before Easter Sunday, when Christians around the world will be celebrating the risen Jesus. But very often at this time of year on the show, we do some kind of Easter-related programming. And it's my pleasure to be joined today by David Instone Brewer and a guest, Bob Price. And I'll introduce both those guests in just a moment's time. It's going to be a really fascinating show today. But if you haven't heard already, and if you're a regular listener, you can hardly not have heard about this. We have an apologetics conference coming up related to the show on Saturday, the 26th of May. That's just 7 weeks away now. So I do urge you to get yourself booked in. premier.org.uk/reasons. I'll be hosting the conference, which is Unbelievable the Conference 2012, giving a skeptical world reasons to believe. And we'll be hearing from the likes of John Lennox, who is went down extremely well at last year's conference on science and faith. He'll be addressing the new atheism this year, as well as other issues in some of the other seminars that we're laying on. Our conference partners, Reasons to Believe, are going to be bringing over Hugh Ross, who is an astronomer and a Christian, and he's going to be looking at the Cosmic Reasons for Christ is actually the name of his seminar. And also our guest from last week, Kenneth Samples, is going to be joining us as well for the conference. He's a theologian and apologist. He's going to be looking at which worldview, clear reasons for the Christian view. And so it's going to be a really interesting conference. Not just them, Krish Kandaya and Michael Green, Bonnie Yulkun are all there as we look at evangelism and Christian evidence together. Hope you can make it. Hope you can come to what promises to be a really stimulating conference. Loads of time for Q&A, for meeting the speakers, for browsing the resources and all the rest of it. And a wealth of seminars to choose from. You won't know which to go to. So premier.org.uk/reasons is the place to go to book yourself in for Saturday the 26th of May. So let's turn now to the subject of today's discussion on the show that aims to get you thinking, Unbelievable.
You're unbelievable.
We're talking about the scandal of Easter today, and do the scandalous events of Easter show that in fact the story is quite likely to be true? We're basing this on David Instone Brewer's new book, The Jesus Scandals. David Instone Brewer, regular guest of the show, a New Testament scholar at Tyndale House in Cambridge, and author of this new book, The Jesus Scandals. He's going to be telling us all about it in a moment's time. Opposite David, Bob Price, who's a professor of biblical criticism out in the States. He was a Christian, but he came to a very sceptical view of the Bible in the end. He contributes to the Center for Inquiry Institute and is the author of a number of books on theology and the historicity of Jesus. And we'll be ascertaining from Bob exactly what he does believe can or can't be believed about the Jesus of the Gospels. So that's what we're looking at today on the show. And let's turn first of all, David, to you and find out a little bit about this book that you've brought into our studio today. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I'm looking forward to finding out more about this. This book, very much bite-size sort of book. These aren't terribly long chapters. They're the sorts of things that you can get through in a few minutes, really, each. So what's the whole of the book about, though? I believe it emerged from a column that you'd been writing for quite a long time for Christianity magazine.
Yeah, the every chapter is what I would call a coffee cup length. By the time you finish your coffee, you've finished a chapter and okay. You've got something to tell people about in the pub. Each chapter is similar to a magazine article. It gets to the point very quickly, gives you something to think about, and it's quite punchy.
Mm. And the scandals kind of come in different forms. Today, specifically, we're looking at scandals that would have been quite shocking. Things about Jesus's ministry, about the details surrounding his crucifixion and resurrection, that to ears at the time would have been strange, not something you'd have necessarily wanted to publicise if you wanted your Messiah figure to be taken seriously. So tell us about how this all feeds into how we now take these stories.
Yeah, I've gone and taken all the bad bits out of the gospel, all the bits that no one preaches on because you've got to use rude words to express them. And the importance of this for history is that you don't put those sort of things in voluntarily. If the gospel writers wrote those things, they wrote them because they had to, because if they left them out, people would cry foul and say, hey, we've heard nasty things about the birth of Jesus. He was a bastard, wasn't he? Mm. And the gospel writers have to address this. So all the bad bits about Jesus in the Gospels, they're the most believable as far as a historian is concerned. And they're great for us. Things like the miracles, people wouldn't have wanted to hear about miracles. But, of course, that shows that they
Why do you say that people wouldn't have wanted at the time to hear about miracles?
The first century society was really sceptical, much more sceptical than we are nowadays. And the new religions had been formed, which were based on false miracles, and the philosophers were pointing this out. And everyone was down on miracles. If you claimed miracles, you were just a charlatan.
And you know this from sources of the time.
Yeah, if you read Philo, Philo's talking about the Old Testament, he plays down all the miracles. And Josephus, he kind of leaves them out.
Mm.
Then no one wants to talk about them. And even Christian theologians in the early centuries, when they're talking about Jesus, they play up his moral teaching and his lifestyle and play down his miracles because they're not going to work well.
Okay, because there was this sort of scepticism at the time. Now, how does that make a positive case then for the fact of these miracles today?
You're not going to mention them unless you have to.
Right.
So if there are 5,000 people fed, something happens, everyone was talking about it, you can't leave it out for your gospel.
Turning to the chapters that specifically deal with Easter, and we'll have Bob contribute in a moment's time as we start to get into this. A fascinating chapter brought new knowledge to my ears, at least. A chapter about a censored arrest warrant, and this is based on a relatively recent discovery of a particular manuscript that for you is confirmatory evidence of the crucifixion of Jesus. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, it's not as new as you'd think, because it's been around there in dusty tomes for generations. Actually, it was censored out of the Talmud in the 15th century.
For those who aren't aware what the Talmud is, to start with that, what's the Talmud?
Okay, the Talmud collects together all the Jewish traditions from around about the 1st century, not very many there, but up to about the 6th century, all collected together, all written down and recorded and passed on to further generations of Jews to tell them how to live out the Jewish faith.
And what was this part of the Talmud that was censored out then?
There were a lot of things about Jesus in the Talmud which were censored out, because when printing started, you had to get the Pope's permission for every book that was printed.
Mm.
And the Pope said, you can't put these things about Jesus being the son of a prostitute and being burning in boiling feces in hell and strange things like that.
Right.
So all the things about Jesus had to be pulled out.
So these were things that some Jewish writers had written about Jesus in these collected writings over the years, and the Pope said, no, we certainly can't have those things said.
Yeah, and I think a lot of Jews were quite glad to get rid of them as well. They were a bit embarrassing. But this particular one has a historical kernel. And it's a great pity that this got pulled out as well.
Okay, so what is this one that does have a historical kernel?
In Sanhedrin, where they're talking about punishments, they give an example of how you might send a herald in advance of a trial so that any witnesses who might stand up for the person who's been convicted could come forward and give their testimony. And then they give an example about someone called Jesus the Nazarene. Shall I read the text for you?
Go ahead.
On the eve of Passover, they hung Jesus the Nazarene, and the herald went out before him for 40 days, saying, Jesus the Nazarene will go out to be stoned for sorcery and misleading and enticing Israel. Any who know anything in his defence must come and declare concerning him. But No one came to his defence, so they hung him on the eve of Passover.
So, now, the fact that they took the trouble to write this shows that, A, there was this story around that Jesus had been hung, this Jesus Nazarene had been crucified, well, killed at least, let's say, for misdemeanours. Now, obviously, there seems to be more than what we just know from the Gospels there. So tell us what this actually represents in terms of the historical value of this.
When you analyse this, you have to take away the layers. It's rather like an archaeologist has to dig out one layer after another to find the lower bits. And when you analyse the Talmud, you have to go through historical layers because each new generation added a little bit to the Talmud and added some new explanations. Mm. And when you take this away, you find the core of this tradition is on the eve of Passover, they hung Yeshu the Nazarene for sorcery and enticing Israel. And this was a huge embarrassment because you've got here Jesus being charged with sorcery. Now, sorcery isn't a misdemeanor, like you said. Sorcery is a capital offence. Mm. It's not magic. They made a very clear distinction between magic and sorcery. There was an example of two rabbis. They saw a camel being cut in half in the marketplace, and then someone went, abracadabra, and the camel stood up again. And the other rabbi said, yeah, but there's no feces, there's no smell, no blood. That was just a magic trick. That's allowed.
Right.
But sorcery was doing real miracles by the power of the enemy. And that was a capital offence. And he's being charged here with sorcery, which means they believed his miracles were real.
Mm. And so for you, the fact that this was included in the Talmud, even though we sort of had lost it and we've sort of managed to dust it down again and find it in certain editions, for you is confirmatory proof that there really was a crucifixion.
Yeah, here they, of course, say that he's going to be stoned, because that was the official way in which he should be killed for sorcery and enticing Israel. But, of course, he wasn't stoned, he was crucified. So they add that he was hung as well, as if they'd stoned him and then hung up the corpse.
Mm.
But in the original tradition that they inherited, it simply said that he was hung, so they had to add on the tradition about him being stoned to try and set the record straight.
Okay, I mean, hung... Would that still be equivalent to crucifixion?
Well, certainly, yes. When they crucified the 300 Pharisees, or was it 800 Pharisees, back in the time of Alexander, it says they hung them.
Right. So that was a kind of equivalent terminology for... Yeah. I mean, very interesting. Just briefly to touch on them as well, you talk about the manner of Jesus' execution and how much shame that would have brought upon a person, you know, upon a movement in Jesus's day. We perhaps have lost sight of that with our sanitized crucifixes today, but that in first century Jewish culture, this was the worst kind of death someone could receive. And from that, you draw the conclusion that, again, not something Jesus's first followers would necessarily have wanted to emphasize if they were trying to win people to their cause.
Even worse than that, they tried to walk back from it. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is saying, hey, come on, we can't just deny this. And so this is the heart of the gospel. And you find in the first three centuries, the picture of the cross never occurs anywhere except in one bit of graffiti, where there's a picture of a cross and a man on it with a head of an ass. And the depiction underneath it says, Alexamenos is worshipping his god. The only time the cross is depicted is to disparage Jesus. Mm. It was such a terrible, terrible way of being executed.
Well, we'll come to the resurrection later, because we've got two chapters here, at least, that tie into the manner of Jesus' death and whether they give, as it were, now, 2,000 years on, good confirmatory evidence of the manner of Jesus' crucifixion and the way the Gospels have it is correct. And obviously this is a good moment to bring in Bob Price. Bob, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.
Well, it's great to be here.
Great. Thank you for being with us. Bob, you're known as something of a sceptic when it comes to the historicity of the Gospel accounts. Just give us briefly your view of how you view the life of Jesus. Do you see a lot of it as legendary, as embellishment, as not original to this person, whoever he was?
That about sums it up. I began as an apologist, reading all I could of everybody from F.F. Bruce to John Warwick Montgomery to popularizers like Josh McDowell and so forth. And I finally just did not find it convincing anymore. That doesn't mean I'm right, but I just want to say that I began this scholarly quest from the sympathetic viewpoint. I didn't and still don't approach this as some sort of an axe-grinding mission to debunk Christianity, and I just don't feel that way. I love Christianity and all the religions. But I have come not to find it credible any longer, and I actually came to the point of embracing a view I once thought was as much of a crank view as Bart Ehrman portrays it in his new book, Did Jesus Exist?, where he attacks me and a bunch of others, namely that Jesus very likely did not exist at all, that if he had, there's no way of recovering what he may have been like, that if there was a Jesus, he has retreated behind the stained glass curtain, and barring some new discovery, we can never know whether there was one or not. I don't say as a dogma we know there wasn't, that'd be ludicrous. All historical hypotheses are tentative and seek correction, but I don't think really any of it is very likely to be historically accurate.
I mean, we did touch on this last week. We were addressing the classic C.S. Lewis trilemma: was Jesus a lord, lunatic, or liar? And obviously, another option that often gets added in these days is: was he a legend? And as you mentioned, Bart Ehrman has come out strongly against that with his recent book, defending the historicity of Jesus. Now, we probably don't have the means to go into a full discussion on that today, and who knows, maybe we'll persuade Bart to come in and do that with you at some point down the line, Bob. But you must have come across, I'm sure, similar arguments to the ones David puts here for why the crucifixion itself has perhaps the ring of truth, because it was not something that would necessarily have been welcomed with open arms by the early followers of Jesus if it was such a shameful form of execution. And I don't know what you make as well about this details about this piece from the Talmud that seems to confirm the story of the crucifixion as well.
Well, for one thing, I don't lay much store by the criterion of dissimilarity, which even fairly critical scholars have employed and still do quite a bunch. They say that they seem to assume that all Christians believe the same thing, so that what seems to offend, for instance, Matthew, that he omits or changes, such as that Jesus was surprised at the unbelief of the people of Nazareth and that he couldn't heal but a few people with runny noses and so on, he didn't like Jesus denying that he was good to the rich young ruler. Well, that or that he was baptized by John the Baptist. These caused problems for early Christians. Well, for some early Christians. But I noted John Warwick Montgomery once said everything. I think it was a debate against Thomas Altizer. He said everything Jesus said offended somebody in the early church. And I thought he is right. And the corollary is that that everything he said that is recorded in the Gospels didn't offend somebody, or we wouldn't be reading it. Like the basic idea of form criticism, which is espoused by radicals like Bultmann and conservatives like Vincent Taylor, is that we would be reading nothing in the Gospels if it hadn't served some purpose for someone in the early church. Catechism, homiletics, trying to prove a point or legitimate a ritual or whatever, that stuff that nothing was passed down out of pure curiosity, it seems like.
That's very interesting, because I mean that is a very skeptical viewpoint of the nature of the way we've received these texts, that everything has passed through this filter of some person's agenda in terms of what they are allowing the person to see of the life and ministry of Jesus. I mean, David, you seem to be suggesting that there is a simpler explanation, which is just that these events happened, and that's why they've been put down, even though they were embarrassing to some segments of of the society.
I wouldn't disagree with Bob that everything's put down for a reason. And when you read history, you have to be aware of the motives that people have for writing these things. And I'm saying, what is the motive for writing things which are embarrassing to Christians, embarrassing to everyone?
Well, they weren't to everyone. That's my point, that what may have been, like it seems obvious to me, Mark saw no problem with Jesus showing up at a baptism of repentance, being surprised at people's lack of faith, being
sure,
unable to
heal
those.
But everyone would be offended by a crucifixion.
Not necessarily. The Spartacus and his men were great heroes. There are popular novels of the period where from the 2nd century B.C. and earlier on into the next few centuries where heroes are condemned to the cross, actually crucified, but escape it almost miraculously. And so I don't think that it's necessarily any kind. I mean, it's like the darkness before the dawn. The story doesn't end with a crucifixion. It's like, can he get out of this? And he does. It's similar to the skepticism element of a miracle story. It has the function of heightening the victory at the end, so it would make sense as a literary invention, and we do have other known literary inventions that have the same sort of thing, crucifixions and so on, momentary shame but then vindication. So that doesn't strike me as even inherently offensive, given what we know of the ancient world. And again, what did offend later people didn't necessarily offend earlier ones.
Certainly Spartacus came from slavery, and for worse form of slaves, you would expect it to be crucifixion. But in Jewish eyes, of course, crucifixion was so humiliating that the way in which you have this gradual asphyxiation, it would sort of resulted in an erection, in defecation, complete shame, because crucifixion was done in the nude. It was for Jewish congregations, this would be just unacceptable for their Messiah to go.
How do you know that? That seems to me to be gratuitous. The deeper the defeat, the greater the victory afterward. If he didn't suffer much, the resurrection doesn't make much sense. And to just assume that, it cannot have been effective. Like, what does Aristotle say about catharsis, the cleansing of the soul by pity and terror? A crucifixion is supposed to invoke both, and it certainly would as a literary matter, and all the greater when you put him to death but God raised him from the dead. That seems to fit perfectly into that narrative logic.
Yes, the death and being raised from the dead, that's a great victory, but the crucifixion is a huge shaming from which the Jews were not expecting anyone to be able to bring up a religion. The idea of someone being hung after the crucifixion, which means that they're completely cursed by God, and something which the Christians almost didn't recover from until Paul said, hey, hang on, Jesus took the curse for us, and we can live
with
this.
Doesn't that just mean that he was cursed, condemned? We thought he was, as Isaiah says, we thought he was smitten by God. That's the curse. But what do you know? He was vindicated by God. I don't see any incompatibility.
The vast majority, though, of New Testament historians, Bob, do take the crucifixion as...
As Francis Schaeffer used to say, you can't settle truth by a nose count.
No, I understand that, but the point is that what's your best explanation? I mean, why would a crucifixion be used if it was some kind of mythical or made-up element which was trying to make a point? I mean,
well, from what I've just said, that you want an awful death, as William Jennings Bryan once said, if St. George had slain a dragonfly instead of a dragon, who would remember him? You can't gussy it up and gild the lily if you're trying to show, he was despised and rejected.
I suppose the point Dave is making is it is such an incredibly counter, just a weird thing to for any kind of messiah religion in that context to use in that context.
Not at all. I mean, you want to show a horrible mistreatment of the saint of God. And besides the death, like, you can't just assume that all of this is history. There are other, Bart Ehrman makes a big deal of this, who would have invented a crucified messiah? That's not quite the point. The critical view, you don't hear it much now since critics are much more conservative than they used to be. But the idea is that there were various tributaries into this, including very likely the mystery religions of redemption, with which Paul even compares Christianity in 1 Corinthians. They had dying and rising saviors, and the resurrection doesn't mean much if it isn't preceded by the depths of humiliation and defeat from Baal and Osiris way, way back there, where we actually have copies of texts hundreds of years before the New Testament.
Well, let's allow David to respond to that.
I agree that if you're going to have a great resurrection, you've got to have a great death, but not a shameful death. If I'd invented it, I would have had Jesus dying in a fight or in the arena, being in front of crowds, being honoured.
Putting
in his
up
death.
A really good fight, basically, and you know, just being clinched at the last minute.
That seems to me it's possible, but it's just so speculative. You can hardly say that closes
just
the case.
As speculative in that sense, though, Bob. In as much as if you're saying, oh, it's more probable that it arose from some kind of mythic element from paganism. I mean, there's a lot of speculation in that, isn't there?
Oh, yes, there is. But, of course, I'm saying that all of these things are hypotheses. I don't think you can prove anything. I'm not trying to put the weight on it that David is, I believe, as I understand him.
Yes, I have great difficulty putting aside all of history and saying this didn't happen when you have references to it in Jewish and Roman sources to say that the Gospels then are also wrong.
Do you really have such testimony? Aren't they just based on current Christian preaching? Nobody was there and says, well, I happened to see the crucifixion of the Nazarene. And if you did have that, that would shut me up about the Christ myth theory.
I mean, what do you make? It'd be interesting to know what you make of this issue of the Talmud and the censored passage about the arrest warrant on Passover. And whether you think that in any way adds anything to David's case, Bob?
I fear not. I'm a little surprised that anybody is willing to take material from the Talmud, where, as you say, they do also say Jesus can be found today boiling in dung. I mean, this is just all sorts of vilification. Frank Zindler wrote a great book called The Jesus the Jews Never Knew, where he does a very close scrutiny of all the texts allegedly referring to Jesus. But I see in this attempt to peel back the layers the same sort of approach apologists use with the Testimonium Flavianum, the supposed testimony of Josephus to Jesus, where as a whole it can't possibly be legitimate. So they try to make a bad piece of evidence into a good one by paring away the most incompatible, implausible parts and saying the rest of it is a historical core. I can't buy that when Gerd Ludemann does it with the Book of Acts, saying let's strip away this and that and what's left might be true. That's just, you have to use Occam's razor that you
David, come back on that, because that is essentially the approach you're taking with this section of the Talmud, that you're saying paring away what is obviously just rhetoric against Jesus. We can see that it was based on something that was going at the time, that Jesus had suffered this kind of a death.
Yeah, it's a normal way of reading the Talmud. It's not a special way of pulling layers away, because that's the way the Talmud is written. It was written not in one go. It was written over many generations.
But that whole piece is of one layer, isn't it?
Oh, that whole piece is not one layer, certainly not, because we have parallel sources which quote the on the eve of the Passover they hung Yeshua the Nazarene, and also for sorcery and enticing Israel. We have earlier sources for those, but not for anything else. And we even have Justin Martyr quoting the two charges for sorcery and enticing Israel.
Well, that's in the Gospels, too. I mean, do you have actual Talmudic texts? Maybe you do. I'm no expert in that.
Sorry, you have to read my academic paper on it. But yes, the Talmudic parallels those lines, but not to the others.
Interesting stuff. We're going to take a break here. We're already over time in this section. So I'll give the ways to get in touch after a short break, rather than doing that now, and just let you know that we're talking about the scandal of Easter, looking at whether we can trust the gospel accounts of what happened at Easter because of some of the scandalous details that are included within them. Would anybody try to start a religion on a dying Messiah on a cross? Well, it seems like a really unlikely way, says David, if you were fabricating this. It can only be included because it really did happen that way. There were people around to point it out. So on the other side of this conversation, Bob Price, who obviously takes a very sceptical view of David's approach for looking at this evidence. I hope you can join us again in a short moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable. It's Saturday afternoon, special Easter edition of the show today, as we look at the Jesus scandals with David Instone Brewer and with my other guest, Bob Price. And worth saying at this point that you can get your hands on 10 copies away, David's making available, of the Jesus scandals. So we've been running quite a few book competitions recently, and here's another one. If you want to get hold of a copy of that, the usual way to do it, email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or you can get in touch on the Facebook or the Twitter account, UnbelievableJB, for both of those as well. And what we're asking you to do is, in 20 words or less, tell me what Easter means to you. Okay? I'll accept any answer. Doesn't, you know, lots of atheists listen to this program, and maybe you want to give a, you know, not something that's a sort of hope-filled, joyous occasion of your new life or whatever it may be that a Christian would write in with. But wherever you stand on this, what does Easter mean to you in 20 words or less? And you will be entered for the draw for one of these 10 Jesus scandal books that David's making available to us. So thank you for that, David. If you want to get in touch by email, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk, as I mentioned, @unbelievablejb for the Twitter account and the Facebook. You can also, of course, write in with your response to what you've been hearing on today's programme. What do you think of David's case for the Easter story having the ring of truth about it when we look at these scandals? That it would have been odd, says David, to have included some of this stuff if it hadn't really happened. Well, Bob Price, as I mentioned, is on the line. He's a professor of biblical criticism at the Center for Inquiry Institute out in the States, author of the number of books on theology and the historicity of Jesus. He's in what might be called the mythicist school. Doesn't believe that we do have good enough evidence for an actual person called Jesus of Nazareth. Now, that's obviously a million miles away from you are, David, on this whole area. I mean, you presumably think that there just is too much evidence to be able to discount the figure of Jesus in as some kind of a mythical figure.
Yeah, but in some senses it would be easier to sell Christianity if there wasn't a resurrection. I know it sounds weird to us now, but the resurrection was just too difficult to sell.
I mean, obviously Christians do think of the resurrection as the center point of Christianity. So why on earth do you say that was an embarrassment for the early Christians or for early followers of Christ? I mean, this was, as Bob was saying, the big, you know, comeback after the shameful death. So why would it in any sense be an embarrassment for Christians?
The resurrection's rather like that old Jewish joke about the rabbi who goes sneaking off to play golf on the Sabbath. And the Lord says in heaven to his angels, "Now look how I'm going to punish him." And he does a perfect swing and gets a hole in one. And the angels say, "How is that punishment?" And God says, "Who can he tell?"
Because he's playing it on the Sabbath, of course.
Yeah, but the resurrection is like that, because when they first saw Jesus, it must have been wonderful. And then they suddenly thought, "Ah, who can we tell?" It's just such an embarrassment to base a religion on a resurrection. Because you had all these stories in the past, all these myths about God's rising and things. And that was great fun 4 centuries before. But by the first century, there was such a attitude of skepticism about new religions and mythical people and resurrections and things.
It was very passé to invent your Messiah on the basis of a resurrection.
It was worse than passé. It was quite scandalous. Josephus, when he's trying to deal with Judaism from a Roman point of view, has to deal with these people who've tried to fool Romans into giving money to the temple. And when Lucian and co make their criticisms about religions, they debunk the way in which miracles have happened and the way in which the gods have been talking through speaking tubes and things. And it was such a sceptical time. To say there was a resurrection was death knell.
As I understand it also, others, N.T. Wright included, in their defences of the resurrection, have suggested that it didn't fit with the Jewish theology of the time, it would be a very odd thing to for Jews to have invented a resurrection within time before the end.
Yeah, Jews believed that people could be raised. It happened a few times in the Old Testament, but they didn't believe the Messiah was going to be raised, and there was no way they were going to accept this. And it was a really difficult sell for Jews.
And then on top of that, of course, that issue of the first witnesses being women, recorded in all the Gospels.
How stupid can you be? If you're going to invent a story, you don't invent it that way. Women, you need two women for every man in a law court to give testimony, and even then you don't really listen to them, because they're only women after all.
So was the mindset of the first century world.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply that was correct.
But the point is that this fulfills what has sometimes been termed the criterion of embarrassment, that the fact that it is women that has kind of been transmitted through time in the Gospels as the first witnesses suggests that it really did happen, because you wouldn't have invented that.
All the Gospels are different. They name this person, name that person, and you put the accounts together and you can make sense of it. But why didn't they get the story right in the first place? Otherwise,
this is a funny thing, though, isn't it? Because a lot of people that I speak to think that this counts against the credibility of the Gospel stories, because if you've got different numbers of women seem to be mentioned in the accounts, was there one angel, was there two? Exactly what was the, you know. Now, for you, that's not presumably a problem.
No, you sit in any courtroom, and if the two witnesses are saying exactly the same thing, you know they've colluded beforehand.
So for you, this again is actually, against what you might think, a mark of its authenticity, that the fact that it would be more worrying if they all said exactly the same thing.
Yeah, and you can make sense of all the different accounts if you... just assume that not everyone is naming everyone who's there, and Joanna is the same as Salome. That's the same.
Yeah.
You know, people had more than one name. Everyone had three names or more.
Well, a lot of material there, and a lot for Bob to respond to. Bob, I mean, you're familiar with many of the apologetics for the resurrection, I'm sure. First of all, dealing with David's first point, that the idea of a Messiah rising just was alien to Jewish thought at the time. And if anything, you know, religions that you might say had passed on this tradition of dying and rising gods, it really wasn't seen as... people were just too sceptical of it by that point in time to really, you know, for someone to try to build a case on it. What's your response to that line, first of all?
I must say, forgive me, but I disagree with everything you said there. For one thing, the idea that skepticism was rampant, that's like taking Richard Dawkins and James Randi as typical of people today. I mean, there's always this self-styled elite of I know better than you do, who scoff at this, but even like Lucian, he's scoffing at Alexander of Abonutychus and Peregrinus and all this, because they're popular. People believe in these things. And he said, this is ludicrous. Let me puncture this balloon. In terms of Jewish belief in a Messiah, one error I think that apologetics makes is to assume, for theological reasons, that the Old Testament grows simply out of the New with no other real tributaries. And so we have to look for evidence of what Jews believed and what the Old Testament said about the Messiah and restrict it to that. But there are other tributaries, I think. For instance, the Osiris religion, familiar to Jews from long, long ago. You can even see evidence of it in the Joseph and his brethren stories. Here you have the resurrected one, Osiris, because Isis searched for the body, found it, anointed it with oil, and thus raised it from the dead. If Jesus, the Christ, the anointed one, originally meant the resurrected one in a context like that, as I think it did, then trying to square him with the Davidic Jewish Messiah is a later attempt to assimilate this into more Pharisaic-type Judaism, and certainly that's a big issue with the fact that Jesus doesn't look much like a Davidic Messiah in any other way, so it's not surprising there might be other feeds. this thing about what the point Wright makes is that there was no belief in an eschatological resurrection before the end of the ages. So for them to believe Jesus rose in such a way beforehand, that, you know, nobody could have thought of such a thing. It's unthinkable. So it must actually have happened. The Gospel of Mark has people before Jesus' death saying that they think he is John the Baptist raised from the dead, and not in the way the widow of Nain's son or Jairus' daughter was, but this is John raised from the dead. That is why these dunamoi, these miraculous powers, are at work in him. They thought that was an eschatological resurrection. So it's not like nobody could think that, plus the fact that the early church, as in 1 Corinthians, seemed to view the resurrection of Christ as the first fruits of the harvest, means that this wasn't in the middle of time, as Conselman calls it. This is the beginning of the end. So I just don't see anything to that. To just hit a couple of the other points quick, the idea of an idea seeming so bizarre, who would have invented it? I guess that means we have to believe in the crazy Raelian sect who claimed to have cloned somebody, and that aliens cloned whatever and generated the human race, for instance. I mean, that sounds crazy to me, but I think they did make it up. Everything sounds plausible to somebody. The notion of the women... you have to keep in mind how Mark tells us that the women didn't say anything to anybody, and the other Gospels just change that so that, oh no, they did say something to somebody. And if you leave it with Mark, you notice that he says that, of course, they didn't say anything to anybody, which it seems to me transparently to be saying, this is why you've never heard of this until this late in the day, which casts great suspicion on it. I think that, again, comes from the women's mourning cults of the mystery religions, which were still quite active, and the resurrection belief was quite common among a lot of people, though your snooty intellectuals didn't believe in it. And finally, you just seem to be assuming that if it didn't all happen, that the resurrection stories were written by some committee trying to foist a hoax on everybody. Nobody thinks that. That's the idea, is that there are all sorts of variant oral traditions. Who knows where they come from?
Well, you've responded pretty much to every point there, and so I don't know whether we'll sort of go through the list and have you respond in turn, David. I mean, to come back to the issue of whether this is... whether there are elements of pagan traditions that have flowed into what was influencing people at the time. They weren't just influenced by the Old Testament. I mean, do you agree with that?
Oh, certainly, yes. And if they were just influenced by the Old Testament, I think the resurrection wouldn't have been such a hard sell, because in the Old Testament you do have some resurrections. You know, you have Elisha's body causing someone to be resurrected, and you have Moses disappearing but sort of not being quite dead. You have... Yeah, it's... and. But later, you don't have this same sort of miracleism in Judaism. That they move away from miracles, and that although the Pharisees believe in resurrection per se, resurrection at the end of time, they don't believe in miracles happening actually in the present.
I mean, as far as I understand it, the Christian movement, when it got going, was a Jewish movement, in the sense that obviously it quickly spread beyond that, but... how much would people at the time, Jews, have kind of given credence to certain pagan philosophies and mystery cults and that sort of thing?
Well, you always have some mixing. It's nice to think that Judaism stayed on one side and that all pagans stayed on the other side. You always have mixing of things, and as Bob says, you always have some crazies who believe anything. But it's interesting to know how it's going to be portrayed, how the story is going to be spread, how they're going to decide what goes in these Gospels when they actually publish them. There's lots of oral stories going around, but someone has to decide that these bits, we put them together, and that will help people to believe. And Mark says quite blatantly, I want people to believe that this was the Son of God. How are you going to do that? And you've got to choose bits. And you wouldn't choose a resurrection unless you had to.
And you wouldn't choose women either, as Mark obviously does.
Yeah, I wouldn't choose them, no, not if you're making it up. But if you already have stories going around, you can't just dismiss it. You can't say, oh, well, it didn't quite happen
now,
like
now,
that.
Now, Bob seems to be suggesting, well, if the women are there, it's because they are some hangover from a sort of a cult where there was some female burial sort of rituals going on, and so that could explain their embarrassing presence. Now, is that a plausible thought for where the women come from in the Gospels?
Not because of some religion, some strange religion, but that they're there to make sure that the body is wrapped up properly with the right spices and things. That's a normal ritual for taking care of a body. That's not the embarrassing thing. It's that they were the first witnesses of the resurrection, because you don't see Jesus there. He's not there. They go to the tomb and find he's not. He's missing. But then you suddenly have Mary being the first witness of Jesus, and then you have the women seeing the angels. They become the witnesses rather than just the servants.
The issue of whether Jesus' resurrection was this unusual break with eschatological theology of the time. Bob makes the case that the fact that earlier on in Mark, people are asking whether Jesus is Elijah resurrected.
Or
Jesus is John resurrected. Sure. Apologies. Sure, yeah. Yes. Now, so is that again a proof that actually people didn't have a problem with the idea, and so it's not that unusual or unnatural or scandalous to suggest that Jesus died and rose again?
Well, they knew it wasn't John's body, because they knew what John looked like, they knew what Jesus looked like, and Jesus had been around for a bit longer than John. But it was a sort of inheritance of his psyche, being a reincarnation or something of John. It was a rather different sort of resurrection they were talking about.
Right.
But
how do you know that? I mean, would most people, it's not like they had CNN, and that people had, probably a lot of people had seen John once from a distance and Jesus from a distance. Would people really know that? I mean, Jesus has to even be pointed out in the Garden of Gethsemane, which one of you guys is Jesus?
You're absolutely right, and there'd be people who would say, hey, I don't know what he looks like, but there'd also be people who say, no, there's no way, I've seen them.
Would you necessarily hear that? I mean, of course, Jesus is saying that he isn't, but that doesn't mean that this option didn't exist in popular religious rumor.
Yeah, I love your idea that they're crazies who believe anything, and even in our society, and that your image of the spaceship impregnating people. It's, they're always...
You know, that introduced a new type of epistemology. You could tell who had a false doctrine by looking at their hair. You ever see one of the spokesmen for this group on TV? You just take a look at them. They might as well be wearing a straitjacket. Sorry, that's off the topic.
It's something I've got to look into. It sounds too much fun. But when they took the message to the Areopagus and some mentions of Jesus and the resurrection, they thought they were talking about two new gods, you know, Jesus and Anastasia, because they just couldn't believe that he was an intelligent guy who was talking about a resurrection. And when they
But they're Stoics and Epicureans. Yeah, this isn't your average Jew or Gentile.
They were certainly not average. They were the elites that you talk about. But Festus also, when he's talking to Paul, he says, Paul, you've gone mad. This is a crazy story. And the gospel writers, when they're putting together the accounts, they're not going to choose the bits which are going to appall people and put them off. They're going to choose the bits which they have to choose because, hey, there's no way around this bit.
Well, you're saying both at the same time. They're not going to put the appalling stuff, and yet you say that's just what they did.
They can't escape it.
I mean, you want to find a way, it appears to me, Bob, of explaining some of the scandalous material that David obviously says is there because it happened and they just have no choice but to include it as hangovers from other tributaries, as you call them, into
which weren't offensive to people,
which weren't instance, you say the women, I don't know if I expressed this very well, but okay, David says the women are there, that's scandalous, it must have been true.
That's just not true. In fact, women could testify in areas of expertise, such as mourning and the preparation of bodies. But even if you, I mean, even that's given it too much credit historically, the fact that Mark knows no one has heard of this, and he doesn't even explain how he knows, and of course he knows.
I'm interested in your reading that when Mark says that the women told no one, that proves that no one knew about the women's testimony. I mean, is that the best way of reading it as far as you're concerned, David?
It's an idea I hadn't come across before. I suppose you mean if we dispose of the ending of Mark and that there wasn't any ending that's been lost, then the gospel just ends with the women running away because they're afraid.
William Bousset posited that decades ago. Boltman also mentions it. It's like the transfiguration thing. Now, don't you go telling anybody this until the resurrection. What resurrection? It's aimed at the reader. And it's a way of saying, you never heard about this until the resurrection, probably because it was originally a resurrection story. And for some reason, Mark or someone doesn't like that. So they say, no, this is a vision that happened earlier on. I know you didn't hear about it as something previous to the resurrection, because for some unknown reason Jesus told them to keep it under their turbans. It just sounds like to me that someone is special pleading. It's like they're trying to rearrange the chronology.
In that case, I think Mark was a little bit foolish to have the feeding of 4,000 and of 5,000 in that little area of rural of Galilee, where everyone knew everyone, and someone would have known someone who would have been fed there.
But we're not told that anybody but the disciples understood where the food came from.
Oh, well, we get the impression that people followed Jesus around after that, wanting some more food. That's in John,
that's in the later Gospel of John, where everything is so symbolic and rewritten in light of it, that no such thing is said in Mark.
Well, I mean, on this issue, though, of women, I mean, obviously we're very much... just very different interpretations of what this evidence is about. For David, Mark has women, all the Gospels have women as the first witnesses of Jesus, and it just doesn't make any sense for them to include women in the nature of the time when their testimony was seen as had so much less value in that sense.
Well, not among women. If this originated in the women's mourning cults, which we know are part of the other mystery religions at the time, as Plutarch tells us about Isis and Osiris, these women created the stories and wouldn't have had any problem. 1 Corinthians 15 attests that not everybody even included these people among the witnesses, probably a la Mark 16:8, because they'd never heard of it. So it's not like that men would have invented it, but women would have, and eventually it enters the stream of tradition. At least this is so plausible, it just undermines any kind of evidence that demands a verdict approach. It says, look, what else could it be? It could be a lot of things.
I just can't see this different religious cult coming in and taking care of the body of Jesus as an explanation. But I'll have to look into it more, and maybe
I don't mean that they actually did this. My point is, it's just an ideological legend for such a cult. There's no historical Osiris, but there were women who were mourning his death ritually. Ezekiel mentions those who mourn for Tammuz, same thing.
Sure, but the way it's written in the Gospels, the women were there, and a perfectly plausible reason for looking.
It's been historicized. I'm not trying to say the whole thing reads like it's in Bullfinch's mythology. It's been historicized. This was common with myths. They're placed in historical settings, and that's when myths become legends.
I just wonder, Bob, whether we're entitled to kind of go with the most skeptical approach every time, though. I mean, it was not, presumably, as far as you're aware, from your understanding of tradition at the time, in any way unusual for women to go and do that aspect of the anointing of the body.
Yeah,
and
certainly.
Sort of
the women
certainly,
would do that.
Yeah.
After the first year, a man, probably the oldest son, would look after the bones. But for looking after the body in the first place, women would...
And I mean, obviously, it sounds, David, that you haven't particularly come across Bob's objection of the fact that he believes that it's possible that these other cults were influential in the backstory that went into creating the story of the resurrection. But from your point of view, is that likely in the time of that we're talking about, that people would have been influenced, would have these other stories would have crept into what eventually became Mark's gospel, that a kind of syncretistic kind of drawing on many different traditions to make this resurrection story. Is that a plausible scenario for you?
We know syncretism happened. We'd have not very much evidence of it, but it was obviously an important thing. But if it had been like that, I would have expected the women to come in and anoint the body and the body arise, because that would have been closer to the myth. It
Well, my hunch is they did. The anointing of Bethany was originally that piece of the puzzle, but to avoid this, it's transferred elsewhere to where it doesn't really even make much sense. We don't know why the woman anointed him in Mark, and it says wherever this is told, her name will be remembered, and she isn't even named. I mean, there's some kind of redaction or censorship in it. Things have been juggled around in order to avoid this being so obvious, and yet none of it involves syncretism from other faiths. The daughters of Jerusalem already were in women's mourning cults for a dying and rising God centuries before. It didn't even need to be imported.
We're doing quite a bit of moving around and surmising and possibilities and...
That's not a surprise if you grant the basic notion that stories were collected. Who knew what the proper order was? They still debate that as to, did Jesus actually cleanse the temple twice? Were there really two feedings of the multitude with the disciples equally dumbfounded each time when Jesus says, let's feed them? How can we do that? It's certainly, there's loads of evidence of all kinds of repetition, suppression, and juggling of the various gospel pericope. Use a fancy word.
Let's just allow David to conclude, and then we'll move on from this area of discussion.
Yeah, I'd love to bring in another piece of evidence at this late stage.
Save it for the next, just okay. After the break, and we'll bring it in then.
It's a lovely story that you're creating, and I'm going to have to go and have a look at it. But it seems like too much juggling for my liking.
Well, why don't we just call a slightly early break at this point, and then we'll bring in that extra piece of evidence that you'd like to present in the last section of the show today. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. The scandal of Easter today. In his new book, The Jesus Scandals, David Instone Brewer presents a number of parts of the Gospels which he says were so scandalous to the people of the time that it just wouldn't have made any sense for someone who was trying to create a new religion out of nothing or out of myth to have included them. Things like the shameful execution of Jesus, the nature of the resurrection and the people who discovered it. What we've been talking, though, and obviously hearing a different side of that from Bob Price, who's from the US, is a professor of biblical criticism out there and very much takes a sceptical view of the historicity of the gospel accounts to compare to David. So if you'd like to get in touch and you'd like to give us your thoughts, do email in. You can also get in touch by phone. I'll give the phone number out in the next section of the program. But also the Twitter and Facebook accounts are all there for the taking. And don't forget, you can get your hands on a copy of The Jesus Scandals. 10 copies to give away. Lots of book giveaways we've been doing recently on the show. Just tell us what Easter means to you in 20 words or less, and email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or send your answer through to the Twitter account @unbelievablejb, or onto the Facebook page. I'll collate all those, put all the entrants into a hat, draw out 10 of them after Easter, and we'll be able to send you the books. So that's a good little competition to be running today, and I hope you can join in, and I hope you can come back for the final part of today's programme as we look at the scandal of Easter. Welcome back to Unbelievable, the final part of the show today, a special Holy Saturday show, as we go back to that conversation in a moment between David Instone Brewer and Bob Price. But come back again next week for another Christian, non-Christian discussion. We'll be joined by Andrew Wilson, who is becoming a popular author now. He's part of the New Frontiers Network of Churches, but a young apologist, and he's written a book called If God, Then What, which really is a kind of introduction for many lay people, I suppose, to apologetics, to the arguments for God. He'll be in conversation with atheist Jeff Lillis, who was on a few weeks ago, discussing what's wrong with the world. That's what will be the question we'll be looking at on the back of Andrew's book. So I hope you can come back for that. Don't forget, you can find past programmes as well, those ones that Jeff Lillis contributed to on miracles, at the podcast, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to the conference webpage as well, where you can book in for Saturday the 26th of May. premier.org.uk/reasons is also the place to go for Unbelievable, the conference 2012, in partnership with Reasons to Believe. Ken Samples, Hugh Ross of Reasons to Believe will be joining us as two of our keynote speakers, also being joined by John Lennox, also Michael Green, and Bonnie Yule Kuhn, Krish Kandaya. evangelism and Christian evidence, putting them together, that's what it's all about, giving a skeptical world reasons to believe, is the subtitle of the conference. So I hope you can join me for that. premier.org.uk/reasons.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we're just concluding the programme today on the Jesus scandals. By the way, David Instone Brewer, who's the author of the book, will be returning in a few weeks' time for another very interesting discussion on a theological aspect of the book. Was Jesus a Calvinist, we'll be asking, and we're going to be joined by James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries, who I believe you debated in the past, Bob, is that correct?
Yeah, what a wonderful guy, yeah.
Okay, he spoke, he said that it restored your faith in debate, he said, was
yeah,
the, what you
right.
said to him.
Yeah, that's right, it may have become wearying, and he was really fascinating, engaging, and just a great guy.
Yeah, I must look that one up and listen to it. But in any case, Bob, I think what we're going to do now is just start to draw things to a close. Bob Price, by the way, has been presenting the critical case against David's take on the Gospels. David says many of the scandalous events really help now in the light of history to show that there's the ring of truth to these stories of crucifixion and resurrection. David, you wanted to bring one extra piece of evidence to bear before we start to close things up.
Yeah, Michael Green, who's going to be at that conference soon, he brought our attention many years ago to something called the Nazareth inscription, which is something that's been neglected in the intervening decades. It's probably because it lives in Paris. No one goes to the museum if they're in Paris. They've got better things to do. But if you go to the Bibliothèque Nationale there, you find a 2-foot square piece of marble, very nice inscription, written in Koine Greek for ordinary people to read. And it says that Caesar says, "Graves and tombs must remain undisturbed. If any person has destroyed or in any manner extracted those who were buried to another place or has moved sepulchre-sealing stones, they should suffer capital punishment as a tomb breaker." This is really interesting because it's not complaining about tomb robbing, but just moving a corpse from one place to another. And it's not Roman tombs, because they had urns full of ashes. It's Jewish tombs. Why on earth are Romans worried about people moving a corpse from one place to another? They're not worried about non-Roman tombs normally, but it looks like there's a rumour got to Rome.
So the implication is that they heard that there were these stories going around about a risen Jesus, and they said, would they have assumed it must have been people messing around with tombs and moving bodies around? So let's just put something out there just so that we
stop this sort of nonsense
We can stamp on this because we don't need any more trouble from Jewish zealots. Okay. So for you, that's another indirect piece of evidence.
It's very indirect, but of course it's the sort of thing you'd expect to find. You wouldn't find the Romans saying these miracles are not real. But they're saying, hey, whatever caused this, we've got to put a stop to it, because these crazy religions are taking over the place.
It's certainly consistent with the resurrection story that these kinds of rulings would have been made.
Yeah, this thing is difficult to date. It's probably the late first century. No one's thought that it's created by any mad guys. It was found in 1878, before these things were, before these forgeries were made.
I'm sure you've got an opinion on this, Bob. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I hate to say it, but you could easily read that as showing how common it was to transfer the bodies in Jewish burials, which is just what Mary Magdalene thinks happened when she sees whom she thinks is the gardener. It kind of lends plausibility to that being a natural explanation, and not like the body was stolen like the Pharisees or whoever in Matthew, the Sanhedrin, but this was common enough, it wouldn't have been that unusual. I mean, you can really just read that either way.
I mean, of course, you could take that, Bob, but you're not actually even arguing for that. You're saying that none of this ever happened in the first place. There was no body to be moved around.
No, suppose there was. I mean, I'm willing to grant that. If you don't think there was a Jesus, it couldn't refer to it, but I'm not bringing that in. I'm just suggesting that it just attests to there being a lot of this being done, and that tends to undermine the argument that, it must be a reference to Jesus. That to me is a... I know you're not saying it must be, but the implication that this is a reflection of Christian preaching, it may be just the opposite, that it tends to reinforce the plausibility of the idea that the body was simply moved before anybody knew about it.
Yeah, I'm interested that the Romans are even the tiniest bit concerned about this. These aren't grave goods being stolen out of the tombs. These aren't Roman tombs being disturbed. It's Jewish tombs, and someone's moving a corpse. Who cares?
And for you, they'd have to have a pretty good reason to make these kinds of a ruling, and it's consistent with the idea that there was a group of people claiming things about a risen Messiah.
Yeah, it's a nice inscription on marble, 2 foot square, and with Caesar's...
It has to be said, I mean, Bob, coming back to that criticism you make, you know, this could very well play into the hands of someone who wants a naturalistic explanation of a body that's been moved. The gospel writers seem to anticipate that, indeed, in some of the details they include about the making sure that we know that Jesus really was dead and that sort of thing, that they're anticipating certain Jewish skepticism about the resurrection claim, and they're trying to say, no, look, he really was dead, didn't revive again at some point later, and other details to suggest that, no, this really was a case of a resurrection and not just the disciples stealing the body or whatever it might have been.
Well, I'm just suggesting the inscription may show that this was not some kind of a strange belief or objection that people made. Also, if you think it refers to... I mean, how often, if it doesn't mean that, this is like the line in Jesus Christ Superstar, you Jews produce messiahs by the sackful. How often were people launching new religions based on an ostensible resurrection of their guru? Did they think this was liable to happen a lot? Because if it is, that's another problem. It implies, well, this was sort of atypical, and we don't believe it's true in any of the other cases. Why should it be true in this?
Yeah, I'm not expecting that there were lots of cases like this. This is a very strange event that happened. And, we have that thing in Matthew that the soldiers were supposedly bribed to tell the story that they fell asleep, a very improbable sort of story. The sort of thing Matthew wouldn't put in if he didn't have to.
Oh, but surely he did. Why isn't it in any other gospel? As Reimara said so long ago, why, if there were actually Roman guards, why would we not hear of this in every sermon and Acts and every gospel? But it's never there until it's in Matthew, who also has all these earthquakes and the dead rising and an angel swooping down and moving the stone like Hercules. I mean, this is not sober history, and it's only in one gospel. You can't think that's historically defensible.
It's a historical defense against something. He wouldn't have put it in if he didn't have to, because it gives a certain, it gives a story to the people who don't believe it. And they say, oh, yes, of course these soldiers fell asleep. Because it doesn't say they were Roman soldiers. So they may have been temple guards, Matthew isn't clear.
Well, why would they have to keep it away from Pilate? If this reaches the governor's ears, we'll take care of it.
Yes, there's that implication that they are Romans.
But whatever they were, New York City cops, how could this not be mentioned anywhere else if it happened? It just seems like it's polemical fiction.
It's certainly polemical. Matthew is saying it because his readers, he's expecting his readers to have heard this story, and he wants to go and put his version in defense of that. Maybe that story hadn't been going around till then, and it looks like this inscription is also a response to that same story that was going around. Hey, we'd better do something to stop this.
To stop it? This is liable to happen again?
Well, it once is bad enough, and these Jews are crazy enough to try it again.
We're going to have to start to draw things to a close, gentlemen. Thank you for a lively discussion this afternoon on whether the criterion of embarrassment, as it's sometimes called, applies to some of these stories surrounding the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. If you want to get hold of David's book, I'm putting a link to where you can find it on Amazon with the website premier.org.uk/unbelievable for more details about the book, and we'll link to past programmes as well. The last one that Bob and David did together, actually, on slavery, I'm sure, will be of interest to many people. So I'll link to that and to other shows as well. In the meantime, thank you very much, Bob, for being on the line today, and for casting your critical eye over the evidences that David brings to bear in the book. Thank you, and perhaps we'll have you on again at some point in the not too distant future.
I hope so. By the way, I might suggest people could look up some of my books on Amazon, like The Incredible Shrinking Son of Man or The Case Against the Case for Christ, where I deal with a lot of these things in more detail.
Absolutely. Well, I'll certainly put your website up so people, if they want to mm-hmm. click through to some of the publications you've been involved with, will be able to do that. So that's all available, as I mentioned, from the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Thank you, Bob, for joining us today. David, thank you for joining us as well.
Great to be here.
It's been a really interesting show today, as you've sparred with Bob there on the details of what was influencing the first followers of Jesus and those who wrote down the stories of Easter. I've certainly had a lot to think about and a process in the course of the show, so much obviously that we can only skate over the detail of, but I'm sure
Bob has some great ideas. He's a great sparring partner.
It was a delight to talk with both of you.
I'll just give out the details of how to get in touch with us shortly if you want to enter for the draw as well of the Jesus Scandals. 10 copies of that to give away, a special Easter treat for you. Do hope you have a great Easter, David, and the same to you, Bob. And I look forward to you joining me again in a few weeks' time, David, to continue to look at some of the material in the book today. So thank you for listening, and we'll be getting to some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming in just a moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, before we go to some of your feedback, let me just announce the winners of last week's competition, or the winner, at least, in this case, of the three reissued C.S. Lewis books. We're celebrating 60 years since the first publication of Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, and we've got three copies of the books to give away, Mere Christianity, The Screwtape Letters, and Surprised by Joy. So that's going to, in this case, Lee Trevorrow Earle, out in Northallerton, North Yorkshire. So well done. Lee was among many people who sent in the correct answer to the question that I gave on last week's programme, which was, by what J was C.S. Lewis better known to his friends and family? It was, of course, Jack was the name that many people knew him as. So well done, Lee. Sorry to everyone else who entered but failed to get drawn for that. There is going to be another chance before the end of April for you to win another set of those books. So listen out for details of that in the not too distant future. Now, if you'd like to get in touch with the show on the basis of what you heard today, share your thoughts, do email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. In fact, Bruce has emailed back. I read out his email last week and I made a mistake. Bruce says, I was completely amazed that you suggested that I was an atheist on your show. I have never been an atheist. I have been a Christian from the evangelical tribe since 1973 when I went to university, i.e. for nearly 40 years. My sincere apologies, Bruce. I simply assumed from the nature of the email that you'd sent, which was sceptical of the miracle claims being put on the show, that you were an atheist. Totally, you know, a presumption on my part, and I do apologise. You go on to say, if your view was correct, I'm sure it would make it very difficult for my wife, who is the chief executive of a large Christian organisation. Yes, I do have an atheist friend, David, who I knew firstly as a Christian. He went to the same church as I did about 8 years ago. About a year ago, he decided to become an atheist, and I had, by chance, asked him to send an email to show his support for a Saudi who was being sent back to Saudi Arabia to be executed by the authorities for criticising their orthopraxis of the Muslim faith. He, out of the 30 friends who I sent the respective email to, and who were mainly Christians, was the only person to acknowledge that he had responded, and in his response he told me that he was now an atheist. Well, rather than excommunicating him like most of the church did, including the leader, I decided to communicate with him by email, and about once a month I meet him in a pub for a non-alcoholic drink. as I don't drink and drive. Now, you go on to say, in your programme, you mentioned an American who was asking why he should bother with communicating with atheists, and you seemed to hesitate on a response. Well, I'll give him two reasons. One, it would give him humility. In any discussion with a person who has a very different position and is very committed to that position, it can quite easily degenerate into a heated row, which doesn't line up too well with 1 Peter 3:16. So when one is with an adamant atheist, one certainly needs the fruits of the Spirit, particularly gentleness. Secondly, it would sharpen his use of the sword. With the discussions at the pub and to the date with over 325 emails, these emails have certainly sharpened up my apologetics for the Christian faith. And you include some extracts from emails with this new atheist conversation partner. Thank you very much for filling me in on the backstory there, Bruce. And again, apologies for mislabeling your faith position. Thanks to those who've been in touch after last week's show, C.S. Lewis was, of course, under discussion, particularly his trilemma: was Jesus liar, lunatic, or Lord? And the argument from reason. And that's where most of the discussion emails have come in on the back of, actually. James Croft was our atheist guest in conversation with Kenneth Samples, who, of course, is going to be with us at Unbelievable, the conference, in 7 weeks' time. So Ian in Scotland says, another good programme. On the argument from reason, James Croft responded to Ken Samples' point that reason, coming from a purely natural source, demands an explanation, by saying that the natural coming from the supernatural demands explanation. Surely the point is that reason is greater than naturalism, but the supernatural is greater than the natural. So the argument is that one category cannot produce something greater than itself, but it's perfectly reasonable to expect a category to produce something lesser than itself. Therefore, James Croft's response to Ken Samples isn't valid, says Ian. Dewey has really the opposite point of view. He says it's Paley all over again. James Croft asked some good questions. If trees can come from atoms, why not thought from unthinking matter? And if supernatural things can give rise to natural things, why can't unreasoning things give rise to reasoning things? I would say we grow from zygotes, all of us, from single cells. Our nervous system grows from a few cells into a system of several billion cells. It does so by the assimilation of unthinking matter. Where does God come into that? And if we must get all our ideas from God, then God made a very inferior thinking machine when he designed the brain. But is there any reason to think we don't form and conceive our own ideas? So there can be both the physical development of the brain and the development of ideas in individuals in the course of their lives, in generation after generation of ingenious and original thinkers. And goes on in like manner. Thank you very much. I think to some extent, though, both those emails to a degree are missing the point of the argument from reason, which is, in a sense, reason being in a category of its own, quite different from the material. And to me, there is that issue of, in what sense can the knocking together of atoms in certain configurations have a value that we ascribe to it as truth, and in another configuration of atoms, a value we ascribe to it as false? The configuration of atoms simply has nothing to do with truth, the truthfulness of something or the falsity of something. It's rather like those who say, you know, your belief that if we are, in a sense, in a purely materialistic world, your belief that God exists is simply your brain chemicals fizzing in one particular way, and my belief that God does exist is simply my brain chemicals fizzing in another way. Does that amount to reason in any sense? It's hard to see how you get from something that is non-reasonable in its pure constituents to this thing we call reason, which we all depend on so much. Carl Udy says, I was really impressed with James Croft's performance in the most recent episode. He appears to be one of the best equipped atheists to deal intelligently with the arguments for God. And like Jeff Lillis in previous episodes, I enjoyed that they didn't have an antagonistic attitude towards God, but instead came on to debate the issues. I do want to point out, though, one thing that may have not have been apparent from the show, although you did allude to it. Lewis's trilemma, at least as presented in Mere Christianity, was not an argument for Jesus' deity, but instead to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Others have extended the argument to try to eliminate the liar and lunatic options. Probably Peter Kreeft's argument in his book Between Heaven and Hell is the best, where he points out the contradiction of a great moral teacher with a God complex, although any such extension does put a strain on the argument. The fact is, I think Lewis would have much preferred the honesty of people saying that Jesus was a liar or a madman than the patronising nonsense, in quotation marks, of Jesus being a great moral teacher that was so common in his day as well as ours, and which allows someone to dismiss the heart of Jesus' teaching while pretending to admire him. Very good show. Kudos to you all, says Carl. Thank you, Carl. Thanks to all those who have responded on the issue of C.S. Lewis. Going back to just another email on the Miracles show, while we've got time to squeeze one more in. Doug from Seattle is an atheist, and he says, thanks again for being the only religious radio show I can take. Your show on Do Miracles Happen Today gave me a few points to consider. Firstly, it seemed to demonstrate well that the more removed one is from the original story and the less documented an event is, the harder it is to come up with a naturalistic explanation. Secondly, he seems to have an aversion to healing the more gruesome and gory. I presume you mean by this God has an aversion, sticking to the more mundane issues to do his handiwork. Why won't God heal dramatic and severe injuries such as beheadings, eviscerations or amputations? And thirdly, the story of the woman carrying a snake-bitten and dead child for 3 hours to have it raised from the dead by a priest seems pleasant on the surface, yet is gut-wrenchingly offensive if told to every other faithful woman who has had a child killed from snake bite. Well, thank you very much. I mean, obviously, the question of why God chooses to heal some, answer the prayers of some and not others, is one of those issues that is a sort of separate issue to whether miracles actually happen, but it inevitably gets raised in the context of that, and I suppose is sort of links into the whole problem of suffering. But nonetheless, it is interesting to try to evaluate stories where we do see what appear to be, on the face of it, miraculous claims going on. Well, obviously, we've been over those issues as well of amputation, evisceration, and whether there are documented claims of healing. Well, I refer you to the past shows as to where we got to on those particular issues. But thank you again for getting in touch, Doug, and letting us know what you think. Well, we'll get to more of your emails next week at the same time. For the moment, have a very happy Easter day, however you'll be celebrating it. And I do hope you can join me again for the next edition of the show next week. Don't forget that you can book yourself in now. Once Easter's over, might give you a chance to clear the decks and think about what you want to be doing in the coming months. And Saturday the 26th of May, I hope, might be high on your agenda for getting along to in London at Clapham Junction is the location just down the road from Clapham Junction, Transformation House, where we'll be holding Unbelievable the Conference 2012. Do check out the site to find out more about it and how to book in, premier.org.uk/reasons. For the moment, let me tell you what's coming up next week.
You're unbelievable.
What's wrong with the world, we'll be asking. And in the studio with me to look at that, Andrew Wilson, the author of If God, Then What. He's a young Christian apologist, and he'll be in discussion with atheist Jeff Lillis, who we had on the programme a few weeks ago. He returns to look at this question that arises from Andrew's book. So I hope you can join me for that in what promises to be another enlightening show. Hope you can join me then. Until then, have a good week.